The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Are you looking to hit your fitness goals? Let Beachbody On Demand help you get there. No need to go to a gym or schedule a class. Everything is right there on your personal device. They have programs for any fitness level, and the workouts range from cardio to weight training to yoga, low impact, and even dance. There are over 600 different workouts on the platform. Beachbody On Demand even provides comprehensive nutrition plans to help you meet your goals, because working out is just part of the equation. Access to information on meal prep, variety of recipes, and simple but proven eating plans. You need to give this service a try. Right now, listeners can get a free trial membership when you text FTN to 303030. You will get full access to this entire platform for free. All the workouts and nutrition information free. Just text FTN to 303030. Text FTN to 303030.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a once top secret memo, now public.
The fallout and the response.
Plus, we preview the Super Bowl.
The Patriots are trying to become just the second team to win six Super Bowls.
Later, opioids and the VA.
The VA wants to focus more on alternative therapies for pain, PTSD, and other medical issues veterans face.
I'm Steve Dorsey at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Let's start this weekend at the White House, as we often do. Correspondent Stephen Portnoy is there. Stephen, the House Intelligence Committee has released a one-secret memo that could affect the Russia probe. What's in it?
It confirms that when the FBI opened its investigation into Russian meddling in July of 2016, its first target was Trump campaign aide George Papadopoulos. The memo also alleges that former British spy Christopher Steele told a Justice Department official that he was desperate that Mr. Trump not be elected president.
Why is this significant?
Well, it's significant because it helps bolster the Republican argument that the FBI and Justice Department were willing to leave information out and to go after certain people who worked for the Trump campaign and surveil them. Now, Democrats say it's entirely insignificant. And the FBI has been saying that this memo mischaracterizes its actions and that there's more to the story. Democrats wrote a memo of their own. The White House said late this week that it would work with Congress to see to it that other information is put out there. But I'll be honest with you, Steve, a lot of Democrats who are looking at that statement wonder whether their memo will ever see the light of day.
What's the response been?
Well, the response has been rather harsh. I mean, you look, for example, at former FBI Director James Comey issued a tweet in which he said it was essentially shocking that Republicans would do this, because what they have done is they have confirmed the existence of a FISA warrant. That is exceedingly rare. And the idea that this would be forced upon the government by the Republicans who control the House Intelligence Committee, as opposed to a decision being made within the executive branch, is extraordinary. One other thing. The president was asked of his opinion of this. He goes, "You want to know the truth? I think it's a disgrace." One reporter also asked if the president has lost confidence in Rod Rosenstein, who was the president's choice for deputy attorney general, who was a George W. Bush appointee to be the U.S. attorney for Maryland, held over through the Obama administration, and a Trump appointee to be the deputy attorney general. Does the president still have confidence in his choice to be the number two at justice? The president said, quote, "You figure that one out."
CBS News White House correspondent Stephen Portnoy. Thanks, Stephen.
You bet.
Andrew McCabe, cited in that memo, decided to leave the FBI, stepping down as its deputy director Tuesday. He was due to leave anyway this spring, retiring. More from CBS News correspondent Jeff Pagase.
I worked very, very closely with Director Comey.
Deputy Director Andrew McCabe led the FBI's Russia investigation when it began in 2016 and became the acting director of the Bureau when President Trump fired James Comey.
Director Comey enjoyed broad support within the FBI.
But over the last several months, McCabe has become a lightning rod for critics. Republicans on Capitol Hill and President Trump have singled McCabe out after it was revealed his wife received almost $700,000 from Democratic Party sources in her unsuccessful bid for the Virginia State Senate.
Well, McCabe got more than $500,000 from essentially Hillary Clinton, and is he investigating Hillary Clinton?
McCabe led the FBI's investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails, and his role in the probe is under review by the DOJ Inspector General. President Trump has denied reports that he asked McCabe who he voted for when McCabe became acting FBI director.
Did you ask McCabe who he voted for? I don't think so.
The president has been openly critical of the deputy director on Twitter. McCabe is racing the clock to retire with full benefits. On Monday, in an email to the FBI workforce, Director Christopher Wray mentioned the Inspector General investigation, saying that he would hold people accountable and that McCabe plans to take leave until his official retirement on March 18th.
Billionaire Vegas tycoon Steve Wynn is among the latest most powerful public figures to fall to the Me Too movement amid accusations of sexual misconduct and harassment. He stepped down as RNC finance chair.
And another great friend of mine. Stand up, Steve.
A longtime friend of President Trump, Steve Wynn, found a new role with the GOP after the campaign.
Steve, your job is raising money for the Republican Party.
On CBS This Morning, he was asked about his turn from Las Vegas to Washington.
This administration has turned the attitude of America into a can-do attitude.
The casino mogul is calling the accusations against him preposterous, but on Saturday he stepped down as RNC finance chair. Over the last 5 years, Wynn has donated more than $1.5 million to the Republican Party and candidates. Before backing Trump, Wynn also donated to Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign. Clinton is also facing heat for her handling of sexual misconduct allegations against a senior advisor on her 2008 bid for president. The New York Times reported that Clinton was made aware of the accusations, but allowed him to stay on. Over the weekend, Clinton said at the time the allegation had been, quote, taken seriously and addressed.
Bianca Golodrigo reporting. Scary moments Wednesday aboard a chartered Amtrak train carrying Republican members of Congress to a policy retreat in West Virginia. It collided into a garbage truck near Charlottesville, Virginia. Here's Chief Congressional Correspondent Nancy Cordes.
I know it's been a harrowing day.
Vice President Pence tried to reassure rattled lawmakers after tragedy struck halfway through a five-hour train ride.
Mass casualty incident, level one. Train versus truck.
Hundreds of members, their families, and aides were passing through tiny Crozet, Virginia, when their chartered train struck a dump truck, shearing it in two.
Boom, jarring type of both sound and feeling. Strange, almost like an explosion.
Lawmakers, some of them doctors, rushed off the train to tend to the wounded. In one picture, you can see Representative Brad Wenstrup, a former combat surgeon, carrying a stretcher with Senators Cassidy and Flake. Members tried to save 28-year-old Christopher Foley, a passenger on the truck.
We attempted to resuscitate him, but I don't think for his family that he suffered.
Kansas Congressman Roger Marshall tended to another passenger.
We were able to keep a pulse, keep his a decent airway.
NTSB investigators now on scene say it's unclear why the truck was in the train's path.
We also consider distraction as a potential factor.
The lawmakers completed their journey by bus as they tried to get back to work.
The House chaplain was on the train as well, so there was the ability to administer last rites. And all in all, it was a pretty tough day.
Still to come on the weekend roundup, a man tries to attack disgraced former sports doctor Larry Nassar in court.
I want that son of a—
That's next on the weekend roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. New accusations Pakistan is giving safe haven to terrorists.
Afghan intelligence officials have given evidence to Pakistan they claim shows ISIS and Taliban militants are trained and protected in that country. The Islamic State and the Taliban have claimed responsibility for several deadly attacks in Kabul and Jalalabad last month that killed nearly 200 people. The Afghanis say documents and witness confessions are proof that the Taliban is operating inside Pakistan and militant leaders are allowed to roam freely there. Pakistan denies the accusations. The surge in violence has raised new questions about U.S. relations with Pakistan.
We have an enduring partnership and will work with the Afghan government
to ensure that Afghanistan is able to prevent terrorists from exploiting its territory to threaten the world.
There's no talking to the Taliban.
President Trump has cut $2 billion in aid to Pakistan for what he says is a failure to crack down on militants attacking Afghanistan. Terry Okita, CBS News, London.
Meanwhile, Afghan authorities have blamed an attack on the Intercontinental Hotel in Kabul and a bombing last weekend on the militant Haqqani network. Terrorists packed an ambulance with explosives, setting it off and killing more than 100 people. Correspondent Charlie Daggett in London has more on new concerns about these types of attacks in the UK.
It's not hard to buy a used ambulance. We posed as buyers and found this one on eBay. But according to security experts like Chris Phillips, the resale of emergency vehicles is handing terrorists a lethal weapon.
The terrorist threat is wider, is more diverse, and it's evolving. And one of those attacks will almost certainly be a vehicle bomb.
It's a threat British security services flagged a decade ago when they were being used in Iraq. They're called Trojan vehicles, seemingly ordinary ambulances that are instead packed with explosives.
You're not going to know that the ambulance coming towards you is a real one or a fake one.
Phillips says the fear is that tactic will be imported here as terror attacks by Islamic militants grow.
There needs to be some kind of legislation to stop the use of these vehicles.
Lord Carlisle of Beriou led calls to outlaw the resale of emergency vehicles.
So the very thing that you had warned against a decade ago is still there.
Yes, here it is.
There are still no clear regulations governing the resale of ambulances. Lord Carlisle pointed out last year's Ariana Grande concert where 60 ambulances raced to the scene. Exactly the scenario where a Trojan vehicle could exploit the chaos after that initial blast.
We contacted the Home Office, Britain's counterterrorism authority, repeatedly and were told they're looking into it. eBay says fully operational emergency vehicles are not allowed on their website and they're reviewing the ads we pointed out. Charlie Daggett, CBS News, London.
U.S. officials say President Trump is prepared to consider further military action if necessary to deter chemical attacks in Syria. Defense Secretary James Mattis told reporters Friday the U.S. knows the Syrian regime has weaponized chlorine gas, but now there's new concerns.
We are even more concerned about the possibility of sarin use, the likelihood of sarin use, and we're looking for the evidence.
Fidel Castro's oldest son killed himself Thursday after several months battling major depression. Fidel Castro Diaz-Balart was 68. His death was reported in a brief note on Cuba's main national evening newscast. CBS's Portia Siegelbaum is in Havana with more.
The death was a surprise to almost everyone. No one had any idea he was ill. It says he'd been treated by a team of doctors for several months, that he initially required hospitalization, but that he was currently had been receiving outpatient care during what they described as his social reincorporation.
Dramatic moments inside the courtroom for the final sentencing hearing of disgraced former sports doctor Larry Nassar as more girls and women come forward to say he molested them.
I want that son of a-
The father of three of Nassar's victims tried to attack him before being tackled by bailiffs inside that Charlotte, Michigan courtroom. After two of his daughters spoke, Randall Margrave asked the judge for 5 minutes in a locked room with Nassar. The judge said she couldn't do that. Nassar is already expected to spend the rest of his life behind bars. President Trump delivered his first State of the Union address Tuesday, presenting a divided Congress with his legislative priorities.
The state of our union is strong because our people are strong.
President Trump, in his first State of the Union address, touted all of the areas he sees as successes since Inauguration Day. Job creation, stock market gains, tax cuts. The hot-button issue, though, that could bring the government towards the brink of another shutdown in about a week, immigration.
I am extending an open hand to work with members of both parties.
As expected, Mr. Trump called for the construction of a southern border wall, an end to visa lotteries, and family-based immigration. In exchange, he offered a path to citizenship for 1.8 million illegal immigrants brought here as children.
Under our plan, those who meet education and work requirements and show good moral character will be able to become full citizens of the United States.
In their official response, Democrats, through Massachusetts Representative Joe Kennedy III, told DACA Dreamers, quote, "We will fight for you." He then went after the divisiveness of the Trump administration's first year.
Bullies may land a punch. They may leave a mark. But they have never, not once, in the history of our United States, managed to match the strength and spirit of a people united in defense of their future.
On an issue both sides applauded, President Trump called for a $1.5 trillion infrastructure spending plan, though he did not talk much of where that money would come from. Hannah Doba, CBS News, Washington.
Now to the Super Bowl. The Philadelphia Eagles and New England Patriots face off in a frosty Minneapolis. Our Steve Futterman is there with this preview.
All week long here, the players have been under the media spotlight. The New England Patriots are the betting favorite, and they got good news on Thursday. Their star wide receiver, Rob Gronkowski, has recovered from a concussion. He will be ready to play.
I'll be ready to roll in the game. I'll be full go, ready to roll.
Someone who knows the Patriots quite well is Philadelphia running back LeGarrette Blount. He played for New England for four seasons. He says the Eagles cannot make mistakes.
You got to go out there and play as close to a perfect game as you can possibly play.
As for the fans, they have been arriving here all week. Lots of fans, obviously, from Philadelphia and New England, and they all seem confident their team is going to win. This New England Patriot fan.
My gut reaction says we are going to win. I really do think so, but I don't want to come off as one of those obnoxious Boston fans.
This Philadelphia fan sees a much different result.
The Eagles.
And how confident are you?
Very confident.
Would you say 100%?
Yeah, 100%.
The Patriots are trying to become just the second team to win six Super Bowls. The Eagles are looking for their first. Steve Futterman, CBS News, at the Super Bowl in Minneapolis.
Up next, the response to the VA's efforts to fight opioid abuse.
Many of them need these opioids to, just to survive on a daily basis.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Don't have time to keep up with the news? Try the CBS News Radio app on your iOS or Android device. You'll get the latest news as soon as you start it up. It's that easy. You can also listen to great programming like Face the Nation, Weekend Roundup, or the CBS Evening News.
And good evening. Wall Street today signaled its approval of the tax cuts passed by the Republican-controlled Congress.
You can even download them straight to your phone and listen later. It's all on the CBS News Radio app for iOS or Android. Download it today.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. It's the first weekend of African American History Month, and now a new report by the Southern Poverty Law Center finds shortcomings in how slavery is taught in schools. Maureen Costello is Teaching Tolerance Director for the Southern Poverty Law Center. Maureen, what stood out to you?
Well, what stood out is that whether you looked at what students know, what teachers teach, what textbooks say, or what state standards demand, it kind of all falls short. I think most disappointing was that only 8% of high school seniors could identify slavery as the cause of the Civil War.
Did you find any difference at all in how slavery is taught state by state?
We looked at standards in 15 states, and what we found is that it's just very uneven. It's out of context. Kids are not told a kind of continuous story that builds on itself. Some states do a better job than others, but they're surprising. California, for instance, does a better job than some other states, but no state really covers the whole story.
Where are school systems then and educators falling short when they teach slavery?
Well, in a couple of ways. I think the first is it's uncomfortable. And so in elementary school, we start telling good stories about slavery. And the good stories are escapees, the Underground Railroad, Harriet Tubman. And so that kind of already sets the foundations of the idea that there was this thing, but, you know, people got out of it. And then when we get to high school, we tend to teach it as if it only happened in the South. When it was over, and it has no impact on the present day. And, of course, all of those are wrong. You know, it affected the entire nation. America was built on the profits of slavery, and of course its effects continue to be manifested today.
How do you imagine then this impacts, as you said, today's racial tolerances in the U.S.?
Well, I think it impacts in a number of ways. First of all, there are the clear racial inequalities we still deal with, whether you look at housing, you look at education, you look at child health, all of these things emerge out of the fact that we really didn't take the steps necessary to bring about full equality. Secondly, we see the rise of white nationalism in this country, and particularly young white men are being targeted, often in high school. And frankly, they don't know better. They don't recognize that the arguments that are being used about the racial superiority of whites are the same arguments that were used to defend slavery. And the third reason is because we do have continuing racial tensions. And it seems like a topic that we just don't know how to talk about. And a lot of the racialized beliefs that we still have, you know, the myths about the welfare queen or people taking advantage of the system, were part of the racial ideas that developed to defend slavery.
Southern Poverty Law Center Teaching Tolerance Director Maureen Costello on the Weekend Roundup. Now to the opioid epidemic and its effect on veterans.
I'm Cammie McCormick in Washington. In 2011, veterans were twice as likely to die from accidental opioid overdoses as non-veterans, according to a Newsweek investigation. The Veterans Administration was accused of overprescribing opiates for years. But now that's changing. The VA started cutting back on those prescriptions and is even tracking doctors who may be overprescribing them. But that's not always the most effective approach.
The American Legion has a lot of members who are chronic pain patients. And when they start to hear stories about VA trying to reduce opioid abuse, they get concerned that their long-term opioid use will then come into question. And many of them need these opioids to, just to survive on a daily basis.
Lou Celli of the American Legion.
We get inundated with concerns from veterans who are petrified that because of the political fancy to reduce illegal opioid use, that they're going to get caught up in that dragnet, and they're really concerned, and rightfully so.
Celli is the National Director of Veterans Affairs and Rehabilitation for the American Legion, which is the nation's largest wartime veteran service organization. The problem, he says, lies in what was a blanket approach to a very complex problem.
There is a lot of pressure from the top to try to reduce opioid prescriptions. You know, we see that with the VA coming out last week and giving a national map showing all of the reductions in opioid prescriptions, and wanting to really show that as an advancement in the ability to try to help veterans who may be addicted to opiates, but we want to make sure that veterans have access to the care that they need and that they've earned.
The VA wants to focus more on alternative therapies for pain, PTSD, and other medical issues veterans face. The American Legion supports research on medical cannabis.
Cannabis has been demonized over the years as an illicit drug that's been used irresponsibly recreationally. But the American Legion's position is we want to see if there's any medical value to that drug.
And so do an overwhelming majority of veterans and their families, recently surveyed by an independent public opinion research company.
92% of respondents supported research, and 82% supported having medical access for veterans in states where it was legal.
The problem is still the categorization of marijuana, which has prevented research. The American Legion wants marijuana reclassified as a drug with potential medical value.
We're not saying that VA should just automatically start issuing bongs, to every veteran that has the ability to go to their state and get on some kind of medical cannabis program. What we're saying is that the federal government needs to take ownership and responsibility of this issue, and they need to do the research to determine whether that drug, because make no mistake about it, cannabis is a drug, that drug may or may not have medicinal value. And they can't do that until they reschedule it. They can't do that until they bring it down to a level in the DEA schedule that allows for that type of research to happen.
And he cites other research.
We had read a couple of months ago, actually, there was a report that had come out from Medicaid that talked about chronic pain patients that live in states where medical cannabis is legal have reduced their opioid intake, and they can tell that from the prescriptions that they're filling. So there's a variety of different studies that can be done that could potentially help veterans and really help balance off the dependency on other more harmful and more toxic ingredients like opiates.
Politically, it would still appear controversial to remove the restrictions. Shelley says Congress or the administration can do it. The administration has the authority and the ability, he says, but has so far chosen not to. Cammy McCormick, CBS News, Washington.
Coming up on the Weekend Roundup, a somber anniversary for a space tragedy.
Search and rescue teams have been mobilized to the Dallas-Fort Worth area.
Follow us on Twitter. We've got headlines at CBS News Radio. And I'm tweeting at Steve_Dorsey on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. A tragic anniversary last Thursday. Correspondent Peter King at the Kennedy Space Center looks back at the Space Shuttle Columbia disaster 15 years ago.
Mission Control lost contact with Columbia just 16 minutes before it was supposed to land.
Columbia, Houston, UHF comm check.
Flight Director Leroy Kane knew that Columbia was lost when he locked down his Mission Control team.
No data, no phone calls, no transmissions anywhere into or out.
This is Mission Control, Houston. Flight controllers here continue in a contingency, securing information and notes. Search and rescue teams have been mobilized to the Dallas-Fort Worth area.
At the Kennedy Space Center, with no sonic booms and no shuttle arrival,
the feeling, Peter, was just one of complete emptiness. We went from joy and celebration, waiting to welcome our friends home, to just a pure empty feeling of helplessness and lack of knowledge.
Launch Director Mike Leinbach says he and other NASA officials, including Administrator Sean O'Keefe, went back to the Launch Control Center quickly. That's where they first saw the video of Columbia breaking up over North Texas.
Then it went from a little bit of false hope to complete realization that our friends were gone, and that was very difficult. I remember Sean putting his hands on the table and saying out loud, "I wonder how many people in Texas we just hurt."
Yeah.
On the ground.
It took 20 minutes for whatever pieces of Columbia survived reentry to hit the ground. It took days to recover the remains of the seven crew members over an area of some 250 miles long and 20 miles wide.
We owed it to their families to bring them home.
Astronauts and NASA workers were among the thousands of people who volunteered for that duty quickly. Mother Nature was not on their side.
Mud and thickets, thickets over your head and thorns 2 inches long.
Mike Leinbach has co-written a book called Bringing Columbia Home. In it, he tells the stories of the 25,000 people who ultimately found nearly 40% of the shuttle and the remains of all seven astronauts in North Texas. They included one volunteer in particular from the Kennedy Space Center.
She got out of a vehicle and found herself standing close to an astronaut, and that evening she could not, in good conscience, ever wear those same boots again, and put them in a burn barrel and set them on fire that night. They were brand new boots before that day.
Leinbach says what was left of Columbia was taken to Barksdale Air Force Base to be packaged and trucked back here to the Cape.
And I saw the first shipment leave Barksdale, and they were in, and the pieces were in nondescript plywood boxes. And I just thought to myself, Columbia's going home in a coffin.
But when he returned to Florida, after the initial shock of seeing the beloved orbiter come back in pieces, it was time to get to work and answer questions.
What happened to the orbiter based solely on the debris? Can we figure it out from an engineering forensics perspective what happened based only on the debris? And we did.
By identifying pieces as large as wheels and window frames, as small as a thumbnail, then laying them out on a grid in a hangar near the shuttle's runway. Pictures had shown that fuel tank insulation broke away just after launch.
That piece broke off and decelerated very quickly in the atmosphere, and the orbiter was still accelerating, so that 1.2-pound piece of foam hit the orbiter at over 500 miles per hour.
The debris from what was left of Columbia's left wing showed why the damage to the heat shield was fatal.
We will never know exactly what the damage was like, whether it punched a hole or just dislodged a reinforced carbon-carbon panel. We just don't know, but something caused a breach in the thermal protection system of the wing and allowed the plasma gas to get in during reentry.
The heat from reentry melted the insides of that wing, sending Columbia out of control and killing its 7 astronauts. That was the root cause of the disaster. The Columbia Accident Investigation Board found that the foam problem had been around since day one of the shuttle program, and the contributing cause was that NASA had grown comfortable with it.
We never thought about a major hit on the wing causing a breach in the thermal protection system. But we were also in that mode, as you describe, of it wasn't a problem in the past. It's probably not a problem this time.
And that, says Leinbach, was NASA's biggest mistake.
You've got to watch out for that mentality of it didn't hurt us last time, it won't hurt us this time.
The problems with the fuel tank foam insulation and with NASA culture were addressed and fixed. The space shuttles eventually returned to flight nearly 2.5 years later.
Discovery launch director.
Discovery 2, go ahead.
Okay, Eileen, our long wait may be over. So on behalf of the many millions of people who believe so deeply in what we do, good luck, Godspeed, and have a little fun up there.
Mike Leinbach says that never would have happened without the 25,000 people in Texas who helped bring Columbia home for the last time. For the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Peter King at the Kennedy Space Center.
The CDC reports the number of children who've died from the flu this season is now at 16. Some U.S. health officials are now using new ways to track the flu. Medical correspondent Dr. Tara Narula explains.
Emergency operations team.
It's all hands on deck at the emergency operations unit at Northwell Health on Long Island.
The Suffolk County is being hit hardest.
With this cutting-edge flu surveillance system, they can take in information from all their hospitals in almost real time, bypassing the typical 1 to 2 week time lag on information from state and federal health officials.
You'll see this is up to yesterday. So you're within 24 hours.
As Vice President of Emergency Management, Mary Mahoney says the system is a game changer.
And what types of resources might you send to an area that you see a spike?
Things like, do we have enough masks to protect our patients and our families and our staff? If a large number of this population is pediatric population, do we have the appropriate doses of Tamiflu for them if we're going to be treating them with Tamiflu?
This season, at least 39 children have died from flu-related complications in at least 25 states, and that number is expected to rise.
Kids are vulnerable because of their immune system. They're young, they haven't been exposed to this before, so their body attacks them full on.
Dr. Eric Gottesman is director of the intensive care unit at North Shore University Hospital.
At what point does somebody say, I should get to an emergency room?
You're having problems breathing, becoming lethargic, and coughing up yellow-green, then it's time to get to the emergency room.
Northwell's biosurveillance unit could become a model for other hospital systems. In full disclosure, I'm employed by Northwell. They say their information could help public health officials hone in on zip codes and more specific locations for targeted outreach. It could also be used to track and respond to other infectious disease outbreaks in the future. Dr. Tara Narula, CBS News, New York.
An overdue renovation for the British Parliament.
London Bridge isn't falling down, but Parliament is, and lawmakers voted to evacuate the iconic Palace of Westminster so a desperately needed multi-billion dollar renovation can take place. During the debate, lawmaker Stephen Pound.
This is a place of democracy. This stands for something in this nation and beyond.
Parliament often gets flooded with sewage. It's riddled with asbestos. It has dangerous wiring and vermin, and parts could fall into the River Thames. The evacuation won't happen until 2020. Larry Miller, CBS News, London.
Coming up, look who's talking now with humans.
Hello!
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Like what you're hearing? Get even more great content from CBS News Radio podcasts. Listen to TV broadcasts like CBS Evening News and Face the Nation on demand.
I'm John Dickerson.
And don't miss The Takeout, a politics, policy, and pop culture podcast from CBS News Chief White House Correspondent Major Garrett.
We have our first member of the Trump administration cabinet at our table, Mick Mulvaney.
Well, you asked the wrong people first.
Subscribe now at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Google Play.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. There's a big development in the decades-old case of the drowning death of actress Natalie Wood. That's the focus of 48 Hours this weekend with Aaron Moriarty reporting. Aaron, what's new?
Well, what's new is that these two investigators who have been part of the reopening of the case into Natalie Wood's death are speaking for the first time. Natalie Wood disappeared off her husband's yacht in November 1981. It was ruled an accident. And then 30 years later, the L.A. County Sheriff's Department reopened the case, in part because the ship's captain had for years been saying, you know what, it wasn't quite the accident that everyone thought it was. They reopened it. They didn't speak for 6 years. We've been trying to talk them into telling us what they were investigating, what they were doing. And they were speaking for the first time. And what I think what has caught people's attention is in 2011, when they reopened the case, Lieutenant John Carina, who's one of the investigators, was asked, is Robert Wagner, Natalie Wood's husband, a suspect? And he said no, unequivocally. This time, when I asked him, he said, well, our investigation makes him a person of interest. And that has caught people's attention. He has never been called a person of interest till now.
How has Wagner responded?
He has not responded. He did not talk to those investigators. He has not talked to us. He did, and as part of our report, we use what he describes happened in an interview that he had done with CBS News Sunday Morning. That was in 2008. He also has written a book, and he actually recorded the book and discussed a little bit. But his account, according to these investigators, does not match the new evidence that they've gathered. And that's one of the reasons why he's a person of interest. In other words, they really want to talk to him.
Two other people were on that boat, Christopher Walken and the boat's captain. Where are they in all this?
Well, of course. So Dennis DeVern is the ship's captain, and he's really the main witness, and he's really the only one. I mean, there were four people on that boat, and he's the one who first raised questions and said that he witnessed a fight between Robert Wagner and Natalie Wood shortly before she disappeared. He did not see her go into the water, according to what he's told investigators. He did not hear her go in the water. But he did say that before she disappeared, Natalie Wood was involved in a fight with her husband. Robert Wagner has always said, he said there was no fight. He said that he went looking for her and found her missing. So there's a real difference in those accounts. Now, Christopher Walken's a little hard to know. His story's changed a little bit. Initially, he told police he had a small beef with Robert Wagner, but he did not know what had happened to her. What's interesting is he has talked to these investigators, and they do not call him a person of interest.
Why has this been so hard to crack?
Well, because there are only four people on the boat, because it's a 36-year-old cold case, because Hollywood is notorious of keeping secrets. I mean, you have people with a great deal of money and the ability to surround themselves with people who protect them. And, you know, I think it's just a very difficult story to really find out exactly what happened in that November 1981.
48 Hours correspondent Aaron Moriarty on the latest developments in the Natalie Wood case. You can watch 48 Hours on Saturday evenings on CBS or anytime on CBS All Access. Thanks, Aaron.
Thank you.
NASA engineers didn't have to go far to make a big discovery. More from Chip Reed.
I would say it was right about there.
In 2012, Ray Stanford, a dinosaur fossil hunter, made a major discovery, not in some remote wilderness, but right here in the Maryland suburbs of Washington, D.C., on the grounds of the Goddard Space Flight Center.
It was the dinosaur age meets the space age.
Exactly.
And what did you find?
Oh, I'm looking down on the most beautiful track of a nodosaur that I'd ever seen.
And right alongside the tracks of its baby.
When you first saw this, your excitement level was where on a 10-point scale?
Oh, about 11.
Martin Lockley, a dinosaur track expert from the University of Colorado, has spent hundreds of hours analyzing this rock.
There are at least about 70 clearly identified tracks.
He believes all these tracks may have been made in a matter of hours, just a typical day, 110 million years ago.
And there are all these small tracks. There's a little one going here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. walking around, and that's a chicken or a crow-sized carnivorous dinosaur.
In fact, there were four of them walking slowly in the same direction, apparently hunting for small mammals whose tracks are also clearly visible. It's one of the densest concentrations of dinosaurs and mammals ever found. The extraordinary findings were published in Scientific Reports.
So we got the two experts. Let's go take a look.
After our interviews, Stanford and Lockley decided to check out another rock in the same area. And guess what?
They think
look
it is.
Look at the toe here and here.
Dinosaur.
And here and here.
Another ancient footprint. They didn't seem surprised. Sure they say they're everywhere. You just have to know where to look. Chip Reed, CBS News, Greenbelt, Maryland.
Finally this weekend, look who's talking to humans.
We already knew whales talk to each other in whale speak. And we knew that different pods have different dialects. But we didn't know they could speak like us. That's the claim of researchers who've been working with a chatty orca named Wiki at a marine park in southern France.
Hello!
The conversations were part of a study published by the prestigious Royal Society. Well, not really conversations, says researcher Joseph Call.
What they are doing is they are learning to produce a new sound that is not in their natural repertoire. That doesn't mean that they are engaging in conversation. That's a separate issue.
Not conversing, maybe, but what about math?
One, two, three.
Or name-calling.
Amy!
What's also remarkable is that they make the sounds not through their mouths, but through their noses. Researcher Jose Abramson.
They don't have vocal folds. They really make their sounds with their blowhole.
Which is handy for the whales to say this. One thing the whales haven't learned to say is, give me another fish, although that's what they appear to mean.
Bye-bye!
Mark Phillips, CBS News, London.
That does it for the Weekend Roundup. Thanks for listening. The show is always online on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify. We want to get your feedback. Drop us a line at weekendroundup@cbsnews.com and let us know where and how you're listening. The Weekend Roundup is produced at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Lou Walker is the technical supervisor. Mitchell Fallon is our intern. Have a great week. I'm Steve Dorsey. CBS News.